Great. Thanks, Lee. Good morning, everybody. Thanks to Gene, to Lee, and especially to Aaron for organizing this terrific event. It's always a pleasure to be here. We've got so much to talk about, obviously, with the Guantanamo-related panel. We've got an hour and 45 minutes. It's not nearly enough to even cover the full range of issues we could. So I'm just going to briefly introduce our panelists. I suspect everyone knows a great deal about them already. Of course, we have Dean Erwin Chemerinsky of Irvine, Mike Ramsey, San Diego, Kendra Rotunda of Chapman, and Steve Vladek of American. It's a good lineup of people who have been deeply involved in these issues in various ways and are extremely knowledgeable, well-positioned to comment on them. I'm going to begin by saying a few things just to frame our topic for us, and then we're going to give each of our panelists 5-10 minutes, whatever they would like, to make some opening remarks before we launch into a moderated dialogue. We've been talking about some topics that we should be sure to address, and so I'll moderate a dialogue amongst us for a little bit, and then about 10:15, at the latest, we'll open to the floor for questions, and we have till 10:45. So we're here to talk about Guantanamo, judicial review of enemy combatant status detentions, determinations, Boumediene, and all the aftermath and the surrounding issues. It's actually been a pretty remarkable week for this topic, if you've been following the news, including the overnight news. And I'll just hit on some of the highlights. On Monday, we had Judge Bates in D.C. hearing oral argument in the Makala v. Gates litigation. This is an attempt to extend Boumediene to Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan. As I mentioned to someone last night, I speak in front of military audiences a lot, and I've been talking about the Guantanamo litigation for many years now in these audiences. And very early on, I was asked to speculate, peer way into the future. What might we see so many years down the road? And I suggested that, depending on how things turned out with some of this litigation, it's conceivable that at some point you might see similar Guantanamo-style litigation at other military facilities in combat zones. And I'll never forget the first time I said that, because the room kind of – I got this round of laughter around the room. That's preposterous. Nothing like that. That's ridiculous. But it's now – you look at the summaries and the reports of the hearing, and it looks like Judge Bates actually is open to the possibility, at least to the possibility that detainees who are captured outside of Afghanistan, perhaps they are similarly situated to the Boumediene petitioners, and perhaps they ought to have similar rights. We'll see what he actually writes when he rules on it. But the question turns out to be a very, very live one. What else? Yesterday, really overnight almost, the D.C. Circuit in Bismillah v. Gates put an end to the Detainee Treatment Act review process in the D.C. Circuit. This is very fresh news. So what that means is we've got habeas, of course, still pursuant to Boumediene, but the statutory jurisdiction granted by the Detainee Treatment Act to the D.C. Circuit that was meant to replace or displace habeas review, that's now been brought to an end, at least at the moment. That was the panel's decision in Bismillah. What else? Well, not this week, but in recent weeks, we've had several rulings by Judge Leon in the habeas process reviewing Guantanamo detentions. He's the first judge to come to grips with the merits of detainability, separate and apart from the Uyghur issue, which I'll talk about in a moment. And it's been a mixed bag so far. His first ruling came in a set of petitions involving Lakhdar Boumediene himself and several the other detainees who'd been captured originally or arrested originally in Bosnia. He determined there was not sufficient evidence to detain most of them and ordered their release. He did confirm the detainability of one. And then more recently, in the Al-Awa and the Sliti cases, he's determined that the government has sufficient evidence to detain those individuals. So far, we're getting about what you might expect from the habeas review process. There's sufficient evidence for some detainees and perhaps not others. Meanwhile, Judge Leon is just one of several district judges in D.C. who is engaged in a process of creating a procedural system to carry out these reviews, right? They're creating rules of evidence. They're creating rules of pre-hearing, what I'm tempted to call pre-trial, but pre-hearing procedure. And they're not all coming to the same conclusions. And it raises interesting questions about where exactly they're deriving these rules from. Are some of them getting the rules right? Are they not getting it right? Is this something that perhaps ought to be done by legislation, not by the judges themselves on an ad hoc and apparently sometimes inconsistent basis? And further, what does this tell us about the amount of litigation that remains in the future so long as the status quo is in place? Clearly, the D.C. Circuit ultimately is going to have to look at all these different procedural systems and decide who got it right, if any of them, and then the Supreme Court possibly beyond that. But, of course, we know maybe this is all academic, and maybe that we're just waiting. Let's see, today's the 9th. Maybe we're just waiting 2 more weeks, and then we're going to get a whole new set of procedures or a new solution, which raises the question, how, if at all, is it possible to close down Guantanamo? Clearly, the decision has been made that some form of Guantanamo closure is in order, but I think everyone in this room understands that that's much easier said than done. The way that the narrative usually goes is that there are, you know, some 250 detainees at issue here. Some number of them presumably will be repatriated, although that's not as easy as it sounds. Some number of them, no doubt, could be subjected to federal criminal prosecution and probably will be now. But the question is there what I call the core group that, for whatever reason, you can't reliably prosecute, but the intelligence information makes it unpalatable or unacceptable for a variety of reasons to release them? And if that's the case, what do you do? I had a conversation with someone on the Hill recently, a staff person who was wanted to brainstorm about this stuff, and this person said, well, so, you know, why don't we, someone suggested to me recently that we detain them under the law of armed conflict. And I said, well, that's what we're doing. That's the status quo. How exactly is the suggestion you're raising different from this? He said, I don't know. which I think nicely illustrates, and there's a lot of big picture clarity about what the end state people want to get to, and a total lack of clarity about how you implement that end state, how you operationalize it. And I think as lawyers and law professors in particular, we have a significant role in trying to add clarity to this. We could go on. I mentioned the Uyghurs earlier. There is a subset of detainees whom the government has already determined are no longer enemy combatants, if ever they were. But they can't be repatriated because that would be to China, where they would be at undue risk of abuse and so forth. And it's proven very difficult, if not impossible, to find a third country to take them. And the question has arisen. Judge Urbina ordered that they be released into the United States. I'm glossing over some nuance there, but he's at least raised the possibility of releasing them into the United States. The question is now before the D.C. Circuit. Do federal judges have the power to order their release into the United States? It's fairly clear from what little I know about immigration law that if they had just presented as, you know, potential immigrants, they would not have been admitted. The question is, do they get in now because they were inappropriately or whatever held at Guantanamo in ways that no longer hold up? So that issue's out there on top of that. And just for fun, of course, the Supreme Court does have an enemy combatant case on its docket. It's the Almari decision. Ali Salah Khaled Almari was a Qatari individual who was in the United States, arrested in the United States, transferred into military custody. He's the only one who remains in military custody in the U.S. for now, although maybe he'll soon be joined by many others. And the new administration must quickly determine what's its position going to be, if any, in defending the legality of his detention. I think we should look for something to happen that might moot this issue, perhaps transfer into civilian custody a la Jose Padilla for criminal prosecution so that the administration doesn't have to begin in its first few weeks by taking a policy stance in that litigation. But one never knows. And then finally, just for good measure, let me throw in the fact that late yesterday, OLC posted a batch of new memos on the public website, and it was announced more publicly this morning that they're out there. So if you're curious about what specifically was said in terms of the commander-in-chief authority to enact military commissions, the status of the Taliban under the Third Geneva Article 4, a couple of very interesting opinions relating to the use of force in Iraq, it's all up on the public website. So with that in mind, it seems pretty clear that we'll have enough to talk about to get through our time this morning. I'll stop rambling now. Let me turn it over to Dean Chemerinsky for any opening remarks he'd like to make. We'll move down the line and then switch to our dialogue.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. I so much appreciate the invitation. I think that without question, the Bush administration is going to be remembered as the worst in American history when it comes to human rights. Guantanamo is a symbol of that, but also an embodiment of that reality. I was co-counsel in the first case filed on behalf of Guantanamo detainees in January of 2002. I argued it in district court in the Court of Appeals, and I've been representing an individual detainee, Salim Garebi, since July of 2002. Been to Guantanamo to visit him. I can tell you in all honesty, without releasing any confidential classified information, I have no idea why he is in Guantanamo. Certainly readily concede that he may be a very dangerous person who deserves to be locked up. But I also think, as we know, many others, he could be there by mistake. He's received no meaningful hearing. His combatant status review tribunal hearing was extremely brief and unilluminating. And he's representative, of course, of many who are still in Guantanamo. Now, I've engaged, so everyone on the panel is, maybe everyone in this room, in countless debates. I can't count the number of times John Eastman and I have debated this issue over the last 6 or 7 years. What I constantly hear in response from John, from others, is two things. One is, what we're doing in Guantanamo or in Bagram or other places isn't really that different from what our military has done before. The other thing that I hear is, but it's really justified to the extent that it's different because this is just a different kind of war than we've ever faced. I want to suggest that both of these are wrong. I want to suggest what we're doing here is different than what the United States has ever done before. And I want to suggest that what we've done has been unnecessary. I'll do so very briefly in the time that you've given me. Let me suggest several ways in which this is just different than anything the United States has done before. First, how the detainees have come to Guantanamo and rendition camps is different from how prisoners have generally come to prisoner of war camps in past wars. Generally, individuals have come to prisoner of war camps being captured on the battlefield. Certainly, some who have come to Guantanamo and rendition camps have come that way, but often they've come through other ways which can only be analogized to preventative detention. Early on in the War on Terror, the United States literally paid warlords in Afghanistan to name those who had ties to Al-Qaeda and then brought them to Guantanamo. What we know is that some of those warlords named rivals to get them out of the way. Some named individuals to collect bounties. We know that a large number of individuals were brought to Guantanamo simply by mistake. Likewise, we know that individuals in other parts of the world besides Afghanistan were brought, sometimes entirely by error. As an example, there's the man Khalid Al-Masri. He was on a bus, and he was confused with somebody else of a similar name. Relatively low-level CIA official had suspicions about him, and he was apprehended. He was held. He alleges that he was brutally tortured. Ultimately, the government concluded that they had the wrong person, and they dumped him on the streets of Albania. I don't know of instances in other wars where the United States government has ever done that. To me, one of the most telling examples of how powerful evidence that the United States government was doing something here unlike ever before was when Judge Leon released the individuals, several of the individuals who you mentioned. I don't know of any federal judge who's more sympathetic to the Bush administration from the beginning of the War on Terror than Judge Leon. And if you remember, after Rasul versus Bush and all of the Guantanamo cases went back to the D.C. District Court, the D.C. District Court judges got together and decided it didn't make sense to have each of them handling a few cases. They'd consolidate them in front of one judge, and they asked Senior Judge Joyce Hens Greene to handle them. Not every judge, no judge had to relinquish his or her cases. Every judge did so but Judge Leon. The United States moved to dismiss the cases that were before Judge Leon and Judge Greene. Judge Greene denied the government's motion to dismiss, saying there were claims under the Constitution and under international law. Judge Leon, though, granted the government's motion to dismiss and wrote a strong argument in favor of the Bush administration. In other rulings, he had consistently ruled in favor of the Bush administration. Well, after the Bombardier case came down in June and the case came back to him, in November of this year, he concluded, as to several of the individuals, there was absolutely no evidence to justify continuing to hold them. He, in fact, implored the government not to appeal his ruling. He said that they had the authority to do so, but they'd held these individuals for so long without justification, they should be released. I don't think there's an analogy to that previously in American history. A second way in which this is different is the length of detention. Salim Garebi, my client, has been in Guantanamo since June of 2002. That then means he's been there 6.5 years. Some in Guantanamo have now been there 7 years. That's longer than World War II, World War I, the Civil War. Now, to the extent that the president says that the war on terror is going to last beyond our lifetimes, what it means is that the justification for holding them now will continue forever. This is holding individuals literally for the rest of their life. And I don't know of any other precedent to that. Certainly when you think of prisoners of war, it was always the case that they would be repatriated at the end of the war. Here you have individuals who will never be repatriated. third, what's different is how they're treated. From the time of George Washington, the United States government always prided itself on humane treatment of prisoners recaptured. During the Revolutionary War, England was extremely cruel as to the American prisoners. But George Washington insisted that American troops treat English prisoners with decency and respect. The United States government was instrumental in getting the Geneva Accords passed. I know of no other instance in American history where the United States government systematically implemented torture. And there is no way to describe what went on except as torture. Waterboarding is torture. I don't know if you've read the Jane Mayer book, The Dark Side, and her vivid descriptions of what were done to individuals. I was going to read a passage here. I'll be very brief and not do so. But if anyone in this room wants to say it wasn't torture, you only have to read the descriptions of what were done to people. And that's something that's never been done. I think the public debate about torture has been terribly misguided. There's been a lot of talk about, well, if we capture somebody and they have knowledge about the ticking time bomb, can we torture them? That's not what's gone on here. People like El Masri were tortured with absolutely no basis for believing it would get information. And even if there was a basis for that information, no reason for believing that torture would be successful in getting accurate information. Fourth and finally, this is different because of the claim of complete lawless authority by the United States government. The United States government has taken the position that neither the United States Constitution nor international treaties apply. In other words, they've taken the position that what they choose to do in Guantanamo or rendition camps is unconstrained by any law. Now, when it's come to past instances where there have been prisoners of war, it's believed that the Geneva Accords apply. When it's in the United States, the Constitution applies. But remember, in Rasool versus Bush, the United States government took the position there could be no judicial review with regard to the Guantanamo detentions, no authority, according to the Bush administration, for any court or any tribunal to review what they've done. This, too, seems unprecedented. Now, the other possible argument here could be that, well, yeah, it's different, but it's necessary because this is a different war. But I've never seen any reason to believe that providing some form of meaningful factual hearing before detentions of those in Guantanamo would keep us from having dangerous people. If we have information that these individuals really are dangerous, there could have been hearings and trials long ago. Again, I think of my client, Salim Garebi, who's been there for 6.5 years without any form of meaningful due process. There is absolutely no evidence that torture is effective in gaining useful information. Quite the contrary, what we know is that torture usually leads people to say what they believe will end the torture. There's no reason to believe here we couldn't have followed the law. Like you, I've spoken to so many audiences, and I've discovered that those in the audience who most agree with my position are those who have served in the military or have loved ones in the military. What I've heard over and over from them is, how can we expect foreign countries to follow international law when they have American prisoners if we don't follow international law when we have foreign prisoners? In terms of your question of what's likely to happen, I think the Obama administration will go forward with its pledge to close Guantanamo. I don't think they're going to transfer the individuals to Bagram or other rendition camps. I think that for those who can be repatriated, that will happen. Some, I think, will be just released into the United States. I think others will be transferred and they'll be tried in federal courts. I don't think that they will go to military commissions because, again, I think there are such connotations towards the military commission process because of the abuses that went on during the Bush administration. Just to include, I know that many who disagree with me are fond of quoting Robert Jackson, that the Constitution is not a suicide pact. Of course, I agree with that. That if you could show that actions are necessary for national security, then I think that the government is justified, even at times, in compromising basic rights. But I'd conclude and encourage you to think of the words of the late Justice Louis Brandeis. He said that the greatest threat to liberty will come from people who claim to act for beneficial purposes. He said, people born to freedom know to resist the tyranny of despots. He said, the insidious threat to freedom will come from well-meaning people of zeal with little understanding what the Constitution is about. Now, he never knew Dick Cheney or David Addington or Alberto Gonzalez, but if he did, he couldn't have picked better words.
Okay, Mike? All right, thanks very much for having me here. And thank you all for coming to San Diego. It's always good to have people out here, and ordinarily I would say see what fine weather we have, but we're trying to work on these clouds. I come to this issue principally as a constitutional historian and a student of the founding period, not as an anti-terrorism expert or even really as an anti-terrorism amateur. So I thought that I would offer some perspective from the how I see the founding era and what values were there, and maybe a word or two about how they might apply today in response to some of our moderator's questions. But I'll try to be relatively brief, and then we can take it up specific points in the questions. But what I want to start with is a broad point about the idea of separation of powers, which I think underlies a lot of the debate here. The separation of powers doctrine, as it developed in the 17th and 18th centuries, and as it influenced the founders, has two core components, and one of which I think is more familiar than the other. The first and most familiar one is that each branch should have sufficient powers and sufficient independence to check the others, and that one branch not have centralized power in itself. This is the idea of separation of powers that's often invoked in opposition to the Bush administration in the War on Terror. It's reflected, I think, throughout our history, for example, by the idea that the president, who holds the executive power, cannot be a lawmaker, because that would have too much power in one area. So I think that's absolutely right. That's a very important strand in separation of powers. There's a second strand, it's a less familiar one, but I think equally important, is that each branch exercise the powers to which it is best suited. It's sometimes said that separation of powers is not about efficiency in government. I think this misses the mark. In fact, it's about both efficiency and checking. Consider, for example, the Articles of Confederation. The principal complaint against the Articles in the founding era was its inefficiency. And that charge was framed as a matter of separation of powers. Because the Continental Congress combined executive and legislative functions in a multi-member body, it couldn't operate as an efficient executive. And the creation of the separate president in the Constitution responded to this problem. Matters that were executive in nature went to the president, leaving the deliberative multi-member body, the Congress, to handle legislative matters. And this was something that was done, again, in the interest of effective government. To be sure, the second point shouldn't override the first. The creation of a powerful executive carries with it the need for limits, something that's not always been honored in the outgoing administration, to be sure. But the second point shouldn't be forgotten either. And these two points come together very powerfully in the series of Federalist essays that Alexander Hamilton wrote, Federalist 69 through 77, excuse me, culminating in particular in Federalist 77, where Hamilton lays this out in saying that in crafting the executive, the importance is to have attention to the requisites of energy, what he called the requisites of energy, by which he meant the effectiveness of the executive, and then what he called the requisites of safety, by which he meant requisites of safety from the executive, that is, the checking function, the first element of separation of powers. Now, when I look at the post-Bamedian War on Terror situation, what I see is a substantial transfer of power with respect to anti-terrorism from the executive to the judiciary. Including the questions, who can be held overseas as an enemy combatant, how military trials of enemy combatants should be conducted, excuse me, and who can be properly admitted to the country, who can be safely admitted to the country. Until recently, all of these points were matters for the executive, and to the extent that Congress chose to get involved, matters for Congress. As reflected in the Eisentrager case, overseas detention was not reviewed. As reflected in the Karen and Yamashita cases, military trials were not meaningfully reviewed. And admission to the country was controlled in the early days by the executive and more recently by statute. In my judgment, this is entirely consistent with the this system is entirely consistent with the original understanding. In the original understanding, dealings with foreigners, overseas dealings with foreigners, were generally the province of the executive. The phrase executive denoted, among other things, control of foreign affairs, as reflected in the writings of Locke and Montesquieu and Blackstone, and that conception of executive power was incorporated into the Constitution when the president was given the executive power of the United States. Now, this, of course, was subject to major exceptions like war and treaties, and is subject to general congressional oversight in most respects through, among other things, the funding power. But for the most part, it was not subject to judicial review. The irony is that the Bush administration has actually triggered a substantial undermining of executive power, notwithstanding its reputation to the contrary, even as it's criticized for its supposed overreaching. And what has happened is that in reaction to a perception of overreaching, we have got the judiciary now moving into areas that it previously has not operated. And which, in my view, the original understanding of the Constitution doesn't admit it. So the question then, I suppose, is whether this is a good idea or not. I think it's not, as in general. The framers understood that the unity, speed, and secrecy are keys for the execution of foreign affairs. They understood that the executive had those principally. That the executive is best suited to do this as a matter of separation of powers. Courts, which do not have unity, do not have speed, do not have secrecy, do not have access to information, are not reliable actors in this area. And I think that's the essential question here is who do you think is most likely to get it right? And the get it right is both a question of whether we are going to have innocent people held, and also a question of whether we're going to have dangerous people released. And with respect to each of the points that I made at the outset, the detention, the military trials, and the admission, I guess I lack confidence that courts are going to do a better job than the executive. And I think that as a result, what a separation of powers theory, which asks who is the best actor here, would put this to the executive. That's not to say the executive's always going to get it right. I think there's plenty of examples in the recent times that show the executive's got it wrong. But the question is not who's going to get it right in any particular case, but who is going to, in general, get it right. And just finally, the objection, I think, to this idea is principally that the executive, what I'm suggesting, would be unchecked. Contrary to separation of powers, that is, the power to deal with would be centralized in the executive, and that is something that our separated power system doesn't permit. I think there are two responses to that. The first is that substantial checks on the executive remain. We don't need to get our checks through the judiciary. The president is accountable to the voters. This current president faced the voters in 2004. We had another round of accountability this year, which came out somewhat differently, and I think some of the changes that we may well see will reflect that. Second thing is the president has legislative oversight. Here I have some substantial disagreements with some members or past members of the current administration with respect to the extent of oversight. But Congress broadly has oversight. Congress has broadly been on board with what the president has done. And finally, in terms of a limitation on the president, and this is a very important one to emphasize, we are talking here about operations overseas, or at least that's what I'm talking about. The president has much more limited powers within the United States. In my judgment of executive power. For example, I think that the president's argument with respect to the al-Masri case is much different, the Supreme Court case. President's power here is much less. We're talking about somebody within the United States, presidential power within the United States. Similarly, I don't get too upset about Guantanamo, the judicial extension of power to Guantanamo, because Guantanamo occupies a very odd situation, whether it's in the United States or not. What I think is much greater concern is the question of whether the judiciary is going to extend itself throughout the world to Bagram and other places. So I think we have to remember that when we're saying the president has substantial latitude to act in foreign affairs, we are talking about things that are truly foreign affairs and not things that take place in the United States but happen to have some impact upon things overseas. So my first response is that we are not talking about an unchecked executive, and the idea that we are is mostly rhetoric. And the second thing, the second response is that separation of powers is not just about checks, as I said at the beginning. It is about efficient, effective operation of government. And I think we have to be concerned that in the name of checks, we may put too much of the control of our foreign affairs into the judiciary, which is manifestly unable to handle it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Kendra?
Well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to participate. I'll lead off by giving you a little bit of information about me and my relevant background. I'm a professor at Chapman. I'm also the director of a new center that Chapman is going to be launching actually on Monday, the Military Personnel Law Center, where second and third year law students will be representing military families in all kinds of civil legal disputes. I'm also a JAG officer. I'm a major in the reserves, and I've served three tours in the global war on terror, and all of them have been related to detainee affairs and military commissions. In 2002 and 2003, I was a legal advisor to the camp commander in Guantanamo Bay. I then did a tour as a legal advisor to a team of investigators who are following worldwide leads in the war on terror. And finally, I was a prosecutor at the Office of Military Commissions. And I'd like to recommend a book to you as well. It's my book, which came out in June, Honor Bound Inside the Guantanamo Trials. It details some of my experiences as a JAG involved in these very interesting legal issues, and it also discusses the law of war. Now let's turn to Boumediene v. Bush. Last June, about 6 months ago, the Supreme Court decided for the very first time that enemy combatants captured abroad in a time of war have access to our courts, that they're going to be able to come into court and claim habeas. Now, it's interesting if you look historically at what has happened. During World War II, the United States held 400,000 enemy combatants captured abroad right here in the United States. We brought them here. Not one of them got habeas protections. And there's a case directly on point, Johnson v. Eisentrager. It was a post-World War II case. 21 Germans held in a German prison in Landsberg petitioned the United States for habeas relief. They were being held in a U.S. prison in a U.S.-controlled area of occupied Germany. Supreme Court said, no, you don't get habeas. Your enemy combatants captured abroad, you don't get into our courts. So that's where we were when this case came before the Supreme Court. That is when Boumediene came before the Supreme Court. What's interesting is not so much that the Supreme Court does a complete about-face, but what's interesting really is their rationale. Because what the Supreme Court says is that the combatant status review tribunals, that is the procedures that the military was using to determine who are and who are not enemy combatants, quote, fell well short of the procedures and adversarial mechanisms that would eliminate the need for habeas corpus review. What's so interesting about this is that they seem to forget that this very court, established those very procedures. In 2006, in Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, the court considered the case of an American citizen, Hamdi, who had been born in the United States, was then had then left and had lived and grown up in the Middle East, and we captured him on the battlefield in Afghanistan. When we realized that he was an American citizen, we transferred him to the United States. His case comes before the Supreme Court, and you know what the Supreme Court says? It says that this U.S. citizen is entitled only to very abbreviated hearing. The government can assume that he's an enemy combatant, but he gets an opportunity to rebut that presumption. The court says he's not entitled to a lawyer. They didn't guarantee a lawyer. And they said that the proceeding could be very brief. Now, what the military did in response to Hamdi is that it added even more procedures. The military created the Combatant Status Review Tribunal proceedings, where it did everything that the Supreme Court said it should do for U.S. citizens. Only it decided to extend these rights and these privileges to everyone it was holding in Guantanamo Bay. That is, everyone held down there, even non-U.S. citizens, are getting these same procedures. It added additional rights. Every detainee in Guantanamo Bay gets a personal representative. They have to be in the rank of major or above, and that representative helps the detainee with their hearing. The detainee has an opportunity to present evidence. He has an opportunity to cross-examine evidence against him. He has an opportunity to review unclassified summaries. And what's interesting is the military then created a whole nother layer of review not required by the Supreme Court, not required by the Geneva Convention, not required by any international law. That is, they created a procedure called the Annual Review Board. Basically, this is an annual guaranteed parole board. And what happens is every detainee is guaranteed the opportunity to come before a board once a year and ask for their release. And we have released hundreds of detainees. When I was in Guantanamo Bay in 2002, there were approximately 800 detainees. Now there are 250. So the great majority of them we are releasing. Now some people say, oh, this is evidence we should never have had them to begin with. Well, that's not true. Because the standard for their annual review boards, what the government is looking at, are two things. One is, do we have all the information from you that we're going to get? That is, you may have been properly classified as an enemy combatant, but if you told us everything, if you have, they're releasing them. The other is they're looking at whether or not you're still a threat. And the government is releasing detainees that it thinks are no longer a threat. It doesn't mean that they aren't enemy combatants or that they were never enemy combatants. It just means that they've decided they're no longer a threat. Now, what's amazing is that we have these detainees sign a promissory note that they won't go back and attack us. But what we found is that they do, because approximately 10% of detainees who have been released are either killed or picked up on the battlefield. One killed a judge on the way to the mosque. Another captured and kidnapped a number of Chinese engineers. And one most recently was a suicide bomber and killed 37 innocent Iraqis in Iraq. And so we find that when we release them, they're going back to the battlefield. Again, there's no requirement that we do this. We're just doing this. Some say that we are releasing too few. I think, frankly, we're releasing too many. So it's interesting that in this context, with all of these procedures, that the Supreme Court says that still isn't enough. Another interesting piece is that they split hairs over what court should get to hear these appeals, because the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005 guaranteed that detainees were going to be able to get into the circuit court to challenge their CSIRT hearings. So that is, the CSIRTs, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals, are sort of like the trial stage, if you will, and then they were getting this appeal to the circuit court. Boumediene stepped in before a single case had made its way up to the circuit court. They stepped in and took it away from the courts, and their rationale is very strange, because they said they're very concerned about a detainee who might have relevant exculpatory information that comes up after the CSIRT hearing. Again, they're sort of ignoring the fact that he gets to come before a parole board every year, so he would have an opportunity to raise it. But setting that aside, what they're saying is that what if a detainee What if exculpatory information were raised after the C-cert, and the circuit court wouldn't be able to consider that? They completely ignore the fact that in the Detainee Treatment Act, it specifies that the court can remand cases back to the C-cert if there are questions of fact or if there are new evidence. And so there was already a procedure to do this. So it seems as if they've never heard of the notion of remand. So their decision was really very premature. They gave the circuit court no opportunity to review these cases, and they didn't require detainees, amazingly, to exhaust their administrative remedies before they decided to step in. Now, Justice Scalia says that this will make the war hard on us. He says that it will almost certainly cause more Americans to be killed. I get a lot of emails from soldiers, and after this decision, I wrote an op-ed in the Chicago Tribune about Scalia's dissent and the fact that I agree with it. I think it does put soldiers at risk on the battlefield. And I got the most interesting email. A few weeks later, a soldier emailed me, literally, from Afghanistan. And he said, "I really appreciated your op-ed." He said, "The Bamidian decision has made its way to the battlefield." And he explained that he had been involved in a shootout in an Al-Qaeda safe house where they were able to capture the detainee that they were after. They got in the Humvee. All of the soldiers were safe. They were driving away, and the commander stopped the vehicle and said, "Wait, we've got to gather evidence. We don't want this guy to get away. We've got a big fish here, and if we don't have enough evidence, he's going to be let go." So they sent this soldier back into this safe house to gather evidence and try and collect statements. So he wrote to me that he thought it was amazing that they're trying to have this crime scene type procedures on the battlefield. And so that's just one example of a U.S. soldier who reached out to say, "Look, it's impacted me." And it was only weeks after Bamidian. Now, Justice Roberts has some very interesting things to say in his dissent. He thinks that the majority is, their opinion is, misguided and fruitless. And he says it's really anybody's guess, you know, what's going to happen, because the Supreme Court sort of dumps this in the district court's lap without any guidance at all. And he says most certainly there will be fresh bouts of litigation. And he thinks that ultimately we will end up with very similar procedures to what we already had. That is, he thinks we'll end up going back to the Combatant Status Review Tribunal model or rules that are very similar to that. And, you know, it's interesting because that is, in fact, what is playing out. The judges are having to grapple with what to do with classified information. Well, the military had to grapple with this a few years ago when they set up these proceedings. And what the court has decided, in kind of a blow, frankly, to the detainees, is that you've got to have a lawyer who is cleared to see classified information. If he's not cleared to see classified information, he can't see it. And what's more, in a ruling that just came down about a week or two ago, a judge said that specifically that the lawyer cannot turn around and tell that classified information to the detainee so that the detainee can respond to it. Now, it is true that it's very difficult when you have classified information involved, but you just can't start giving top secret information to detainees and their lawyers. I mean, we saw this problem with the blind sheikh. When information was given to his lawyers, the name of 200 unindicted co-conspirators was given to his lawyers. They weren't supposed to, but they then gave it to the defendant. Within a number of weeks, it was in bin Laden's hands. So we have real practical concerns about classified evidence, and what we see is that the courts are starting to look at what the C-certs did, and frankly, they're starting to come up with a very similar procedure. Now, it is interesting. There is a mixed outcome. It is true that Judge Leon has decided that 5 of the detainees should be released, but he's also decided that 3 should be held. The detainees that he said should be released, it wasn't because he said there's no information at all. What happened was that they were being held on the statement of one undisclosed source, and the government wasn't able to find other corroborating evidence. So those 5 were ordered to be released. But the 6th, They relied on the same statement by the same undisclosed witness, but they were able to corroborate that with additional facts. So the sixth one was held. So five of the six conspirators get to go home, and one of them is going to be held. He also decided recently in a case that two detainees would be held because they were associated with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. They'd gone to various training camps. One of them had given up his passport at an Al-Qaeda training camp, which is something that they often do. And he said that's evidence that, you know, he's working with Al-Qaeda and he's an enemy combatant. He adopted the government's definition of enemy combatant, the definition that was in Hamdi. So things seem to be moving back sort of in the direction of what the government was already doing. There is an interesting case, this case with the Uyghurs. It's not surprising that the court would order the Uyghurs to be released because the military had already cleared them to be released. The problem is we can't find any country in the world who will take these people. These are Chinese terrorists. And it's true that they're not our terrorists. That is, they're not out for the United States. They're out for the Chinese government. But they'll get in bed with anybody. That is, they train at Al-Qaeda training camps. They take money from bin Laden. Several of them were arrested in Afghanistan at a training camp. And so that's why these countries don't want to take them. 100 countries, including many in the Middle East, just say no thanks. So we're trying to find a place to put them. Now, one judge has said that they should be released right here into the United States. The circuit court is looking at that, and there was a hearing last week, actually, where the court was considering and really relying heavily on the precedent of a 1953 case where it said that it's not up to the judiciary to decide who gets to come into the United States. That's really an executive decision, and I've just got the note that I need to wrap it up here, so I will. So that will be an interesting result. What we're seeing is that defense lawyers, not surprisingly, are really trying to stretch and stretch the Boumediene decision. They're now saying that Boumediene means that detainees should get all the constitutional rights that you or I get. And so now there's a case where they're alleging that detainees' religious rights are infringed in Guantanamo Bay. And so that is one case that will be coming forward as the courts try and decide whether Boumediene is a limited case or whether it applies all of our constitutional rights that we enjoy to detainees in Guantanamo Bay. And I'll go ahead and stop there.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you. It's a treat to be here. It's a real privilege to be on a panel with such distinguished and varied viewpoints. I should just note at the outset that I was one of Salim Hamdan's lawyers, that I have co-authored amicus briefs in support of the petitioners in Boumediene, in support of certiorari in Al-Mari. And so I guess I come at this from a slightly different perspective than Kendra. I think I'm going to sort of focus my remarks, because I do want to get to the interactive part of this, on what I think are a couple of myths that have, I think, pervaded some of the comments this morning, and I think are especially pervasive in Justice Scalia's dissent in Boumediene, to a lesser degree in his dissent in Hamdan, his dissent in Razul, and even in Chief Justice Roberts' dissent in Boumediene. It's interesting to me that Chief Justice Roberts says that this is a close question and then has no problem signing on to dissent that says it's not a close question, Americans will be killed. Whichever view you ascribe to, I think one or the other has to be right. They can't both be right. But here are so Mike framed this, I think, in a very helpful way. Mike said, has there been a transfer of power to the courts? And Mike said he thought the answer was yes. I think the answer is it depends on what you're actually asking, because there are actually two distinct sets of questions here. And I think there's a tendency, certainly on the part of political commentators, and I think even to some degree on the part of us, to conflate these two questions. So the two questions, as I see them, are what we might think of as the statutory question, which is what has Congress actually authorized? As evil as Al-Qaeda is, as destructive as their reign has been, there's still the question of whether Congress has actually authorized all the things that the government says it has. So, for example, in Al-Mari, right, Al-Mari is really not a constitutional case. Right, most of the briefing in Al-Mari is focused on the question of whether the scope of the authorization for the use of military force, something we have not talked about yet this morning, actually extends to non-citizens who are legally inside the United States at the time of their capture. Now, reasonable minds will disagree on the answer to this question, but it is a statutory question. Right, and then there's a background question,
which goes to whether the Constitution actually imposes its own limits, substantive limits, on who may be detained and on whether preventive detention is even constitutional at all, right? Justice Scalia in Hamdi thought that where you had a U.S. citizen, at least, who was being held in the United States, the answer was no. The Constitution categorically forbade such detention. I bring this up because the statutory question, to me, suggests that, in a way, one of the issues that the courts have been grappling with is interpreting the statute. Right? And interpreting a statute is something that I don't think is an arrogation of judicial power. Right? Courts do it all the time. Courts have always done it. And indeed, if you look back at precedents throughout history, courts have routinely looked at other statutes during wartime to see what they authorized. So, for example, if we go back to the War of 1812, if we really want to sort of, you know, dust off the cobwebs, right? During the War of 1812, there's an opinion by Chief Justice Marshall in a case called Brown versus United States that talks about whether the declaration of war against Great Britain authorizes the seizure of enemy property located within the United States. Marshall says no. During the War of 1812, there is an opinion by Marshall as a circuit justice sitting in Virginia, interpreting the Alien Enemy Act of 1798, right, which authorizes the detention of nationals of countries with which we're at war. And Marshall says, you know, we actually can review the question of whether this person has been properly detained, which means whether the person actually fits within the statutory definition of who is an alien enemy. This is actually an unreported case. There's a very interesting green bag piece by, I think, Hobson and Jerry Newman about this a couple of years ago. And so I actually think that there is not this unprecedented move post 9/11 to look at whether someone is in fact an enemy. If you look at the World War II cases, in Ex parte Curiae, the Nazi saboteurs conceded that they were working on behalf of the German government and indeed the German army when they landed on Long Island and in Florida. They contested the procedures by which they were tried, but they did not for a second contest that they were detainable and for the duration of hostilities. In Korematsu and Endo, I mean, if we really want to sort of get, you know, emotional, well, not emotional, but, right, in Korematsu, there was a statute, right? The whole point is that the Supreme Court was controversially upholding a statute, not the declaration of war against Japan, but a separate statute that made it a crime to violate an exclusion order, right? In a companion case decided the same day where someone had not been convicted by a statute, a 14-year-old Japanese girl named Mitsui Endo, the court said there was no authority to hold her. In Eisentrager, right, and this leads me to my two big myths. The first myth, I think, is the myth of Eisentrager. In Eisentrager, I think Kinder has the facts exactly right. You had 21 German nationals. They were accused of violating the laws of war by fighting for Japan after Germany had surrendered, right? So laws of war 101, after your country surrenders, you can't go fight for your ally, right? They were captured in China. They were tried by a military tribunal. They did not contest that they were enemies. They did not contest that they were combatants. They contested whether whether what they had done was actually a violation of the laws of war, right? And indeed, if you actually read Justice Jackson's opinion, this is the most remarkable thing about Eisentrager. If Eisentrager actually announced some categorical bar to habeas corpus for non-citizens held overseas, or even for enemies held overseas, why does Justice Jackson spend 22 pages reviewing the merits, right? He concludes that there are no merits, and so therefore there is no problem denying habeas corpus to the petitioners in Eisentrager. But if Eisentrager really stands for what Justice Scalia thinks it does, that should not have been even remotely necessary, right? The Eisentrager petitioners conceded who they were. And so I think, you know, I don't think there is a case that says there's a constitutional right to challenge your status as an enemy during wartime before the war on terrorism. But I do think it is a myth that the courts had never allowed such challenges to go forward. Where someone conceded that they were an enemy, where someone attempted to challenge their status, I'm sorry, conceded is wrong, where someone challenged their status as an enemy, right, there are precedents dating all the way back to the founding where you were actually able to contest that. Indeed, the only case where it's ever been held that the question of whether you are an enemy is non-justiciable was a 2004 decision by the Federal Circuit. About the destruction of enemy property in the Sudan by Bill Clinton in 1998. So I think, I don't think that answers the question, but I think it suggests that Justice Scalia's answer to the question is at least somewhat skimpy on the historical record. The second myth, and then I'll sort of shut up so we can turn to the fun part of this. The second myth is the myth about the DTA. If you actually read the legislative history of the DTA, I think it is pretty clear that the people who wrote the DTA had no intention that the review provided under the DTA would actually look like habeas corpus. Right? This legislative history is cited by Justice Kennedy in his majority opinion in Boumediene. I think it's also a myth that the CSRTs simply provide the process that Hamdi specifies in a couple respects. Justice O'Connor said you have to have a meaningful opportunity to rebut the evidence against you. I'm not sure you can have that meaningful an opportunity without access to the evidence against you. I'm not sure you can have that meaningful an opportunity if you have a personal representative who is not a lawyer and who is in the chain of command. But in any event, even if all this is wrong, there's also this myth that Hamdi applies to non-battlefield detainees, right? Justice O'Connor bent over backwards in her plurality opinion in Hamdi to suggest that the holding of what was required under the Due Process Clause was limited to the highly specific facts of the case, that Hamdi was captured in Afghanistan in the context of active combat operations, that he was captured at least not initially, but by the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Right, and so it is an open question, as the Fourth Circuit recognized in the Almari case, whether Hamdi's conception of what process is required to folks captured off the battlefield, not by the military, is actually more than that which Justice O'Connor contemplated. I don't think that to say that these questions are open is to answer them the other direction, right? But I do think it's important to suggest that, you know, Boumediene was not writing against the grain. At least in my view of 200 years of history, it was writing on what was mostly a blank slate. Now, that doesn't make it right. I think it is. Many people here probably don't think it's not. But I think that does make it less controversial. And so I hope that in our interactions and in our Q&A, we can talk about what that might actually mean and why I actually think it's right. So, thanks.
This microphone's not working, so I'll pop up here. I'm tempted just to ditch the script and ask you guys to respond to one another because I think we've seen there are a number of points of disagreement. Maybe we'll do that in a moment, but preserve your rebuttals for just a moment. I want to determine whether there's any consensus among this group, because I sense that there might be at least some consensus. So bearing in mind that you clearly disagree on the margins and the scope of detention authority that the government may have, or by this, of course, I mean military detention authority, do we at least have agreement that if a U.S. soldier tonight in Afghanistan on patrol engages in a firefight with somebody and captures that individual, that person can then be detained lawfully for the duration of the counterinsurgency effort in Afghanistan and the Pakistan border region?
So long as he's treated consistently with international humanitarian and international human rights law, yes.
Does everyone agree with that?
Yeah.
Does everyone agree that compliance with the law of armed conflict and treatment of prisoner rules from the law of armed conflict conditions the power to lawfully detain that person?
I would say, I think this is interesting. I think Congress could theoretically override the laws of armed conflict, right? I think Congress could actually provide different standards. But I think that given that the AUMF says nothing about this, right, and given that six justices in Hamdi, right, the plurality plus justices Souter and Ginsburg, think that the AUMF should be read as incorporating the laws of war, right, then I think the answer to that is yes. But I think Congress, if it wanted to, right, could provide alternative measures and constraints. Right, Congress can override international law.
Okay,
yeah, Mike, yeah, I agree with that. I think that the question is whether the detention complies with international humanitarian law. As to the question of the treatment, the remedy for mistreatment is to treat them right. It's not to release them. So if your question is detention, the rules of treatment don't have anything to do with it.
Okay, so let's push on this a little bit. We've got a properly detained individual. If he's not captured by U.S. forces, does that matter? If Afghan forces capture him and then turn him over to us, does that change the equation?
If he has a colorable claim that he actually wasn't captured on the battlefield, right? That the Afghan forces who are suggesting that they captured him had a monetary or other personal incentive to misstate the facts, right? The problem is your first hypothetical assumes that we have a U.S. soldier capturing someone on a battlefield, right? And I, for one, have no problem trusting the credibility of a U.S. soldier who says, this guy was in a safe house, right, on the battlefield, that's where I found him. I have a little more of a problem trusting the credibility of an Afghan warlord who has a vendetta against the detainee.
Would you condition? Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was going to say that I think that's right, but the question then is, who is going to make the assessment of the credibility of the warlord or whoever it is that's turning it over? Is it, and that's the separation of powers question. Is that going to be the judge who knows absolutely nothing about this, or is it going to be the executive through the military who knows at least a little bit about it?
But why? I guess, I mean, this is where I want to push back a little bit. Why? I mean, judges make credibility determinations every day. Right, and I don't think that, you know, military officers make judicially imbued credibility determinations every day. So I'm not sure. I concede, as I think I have to, right, that credibility determinations are a tricky matter. But why are they less tricky for the military than for the judge?
Well, there.
Well, I think that would be your question.
I was just going to say, it's always tricky. I mean, it's particularly tricky when the enemy doesn't wear a uniform. So it's not surprising that sometimes you would make mistakes. The truth is, we're not interested in detaining innocent people. If we find out, we hold this hearing, and under Geneva, frankly, I would be a POW if I were captured. Do you know what I would get? Under Geneva, I'm entitled to a 3-member panel who would just vote on whether or not I'm an enemy combatant, and they'd decide that, and then they'd hold me till the end. I wouldn't get a personal representative. I wouldn't get an appeal. I wouldn't get to see all of the information. So that's really what international law requires. Now, here we've created all these new layers and layers of procedure. I do think it's interesting, though, that we're sort of slicing the bologna thin on, well, what do you do with the detainee who's clearly an enemy combatant, that is the guy who's pointing an AK-47 in your face, versus the guy who's picked up in Bosnia, who's coordinating and financing. Well, what's amazing, I think, about the Boumediene decision is that they had the opportunity to make that distinction, and they did not do it. Because the detainees in Boumediene were Bosnians, they were picked up in Bosnia, and were not on the battlefield. But what the Supreme Court says is that everybody's going to get these procedures, even those cases where it's very clear that the person is an enemy combatant. So it's interesting. Boumediene punted on that question. They just decided not to do that. I think it does make sense to have maybe a little closer analysis when you're looking at whether or not someone is an Al-Qaeda financier. Those are closer questions. Those are more difficult to really wrap your hands around than when someone is facing off on the battlefield. But the Supreme Court said they all get the same procedure.
Irwin, then Steve.
What I think is omitted in the discussion as far as there is a body of law here. There's a body of international law in the Geneva Court. We have a body of law in the United States in terms of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so if we capture somebody who's a prisoner of war and we follow the law with regard to prisoners of war, we can do that. What I think is omitted is that the Bush administration has consistently taken the position it doesn't have to follow the Geneva Accords, doesn't have to follow the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and doesn't have to follow the Constitution. I think that's why the court stepped in here. Frankly, I think had the Bush administration taken a much more reasonable position, the courts would have deferred to it. But when the Bush administration came before the Supreme Court and said, even if someone was tortured, they'd have no recourse whatsoever, when they came before the Supreme Court and said, international law doesn't apply, the Uniform Code of Military Justice doesn't apply, I think the Supreme Court had no choice but to say, in every case that's come before it, Rasool, Hamdan, and Boumediene, that the courts are going to be involved because this government has to operate under the rule of law.
Shockingly, I agree with Irwin, but I want to add one point in response to Kendra, which is, I think, so Kendra said, you know, and I think this is a very, very apt a critique of Boumediene. The Boumediene punted on the possibility of distinguishing between battlefield detainees and non-battlefield detainees. I think that depends, right? Boumediene was talking about jurisdiction and not the merits. I, for one, do think and have always thought, and Bobby can testify to this, that there is an incredibly significant distinction on the merits between individuals captured, per Kendra's hypothetical, on the battlefield waving an AK-47 in an American soldier's face, and someone captured in Bosnia, not because they may not both be bad guys, but because there's clear precedent for applying the laws of war in one context and not in the other. Now, the problem in Boumediene is that the court was not dealing with the merits. Right? The court was not saying whether the analysis of what you can actually argue in your habeas petition changes based upon where you were captured. My hope is that the lower courts actually will take up that possibility. Right? But Boumediene was just dealing with the question of whether you get to get into court at all. And I think on the jurisdictional question, it is harder to draw that distinction than on the merits question.
Let me go to Mike, but first let me just flag that, of course, Judge Bates is really grappling with this very question right now in Makala v. Gates. And that's this is going to be a hugely important decision. And he made quite clear in the oral argument on Monday and in the order he issued afterwards asking for specific data from the government specifying, as to the Bagram detainee population as it currently stands, precisely how many were captured in Afghanistan and how many were brought in there from elsewhere. Clearly, this is a distinction that may matter to his analysis. Now, Mike, you had an intervention.
Well, two quick things maybe. One is, maybe we're talking about constitutional law rather than international law, so maybe we shouldn't get off on this. I think it's more rhetoric than anything to say that the Bush administration is violating international law or violating the Geneva Convention. That's a debatable point. Bush administration doesn't take the position that it's violating Geneva. And, in fact, the Geneva setup is fairly straightforward, that if you are a lawful combatant, you get Geneva protection. If you are not a lawful combatant, for the most part, you don't get Geneva. That's the Geneva structure. So for us to now say that these people who are plainly not Geneva compliant, by and large, don't get Geneva protection, that's not a violation of Geneva. It's just Geneva doesn't apply by its terms. Now, I understand there are exceptions and there are objections to that, but that's the central administration position. Now, I do think that the one thing that I absolutely agree with Dean Chemerinsky is that I think the Bush administration has made it hard on itself by taking extreme positions, not necessarily in their actual operations, but in their own rhetoric and in their own legal opinions. And I think that it's right that much of this intervention by the court has been brought on by the administration. But I don't think that makes it right from the court's perspective.
But
go ahead.
I was going to say, but doesn't that presuppose that the Bush administration is employing the same definition of lawful and unlawful combatancy as that recognized by international law? I mean, I agree that that's a debatable point.
I think it's debatable, but I think you'll lose if you're on the other side.
So the laws of war have traditionally sent to little old ladies in Switzerland who give money to charities not knowing that they support al-Qaeda.
No, that is not an operational aspect of the Bush administration. That is a rhetorical aspect of the Bush administration.
So their legal arguments are not relevant.
Their legal arguments are overreaching. But the actual operational aspects of the war on terror, by and large, when we're talking about not just battlefield detainees, but people who are clearly involved in the conflict. Like, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is not a battlefield detainee. So this is why I don't like your battlefield detainee line. And I don't think that there's anything in the law of armed conflict that supports it either. The law of armed conflict does not distinguish between battlefield and non-battlefield. The people in Eisentrager, for example, were not battlefield detainees. They were, in fact, they were civilians.
Employed by the Japanese army.
Well, they were civilians who were allegedly cooperating with the Japanese army. They were not fighters, however. They were spies and so forth. They were not German military.
Let me intervene on this.
Let me just one real quick point. Because I wanted to pick up on what Steve said earlier, because I really think this is the key point, is who do you want making the determination? Do you want the judge making the determination, or do you want the military making the determination? Historically, the military has always made the determination. And the reason I'm skeptical that judges can make the determination is because the usual methods that judges use to make credibility determinations and so forth just don't work here, because you can't call in the warlord. You most of the time aren't going to be able to call in the U.S. military. You aren't going to be able to call in any of the relevant people and have them testify. That's the way judges are used to making decisions. I think you're trying to take one kind of decision-making paradigm and apply it in an area that it hasn't been done.
Erwin?
Thank you. What you said was exactly my point. Once the government argues that the Geneva courts don't apply and the Constitution does apply, then the government's position is what it's doing is unconstrained by any law whatsoever.
No,
and I don't think that's a position.
Just understand. Unconstrained by judgment.
No, I didn't interrupt you.
Okay, sure.
And I think that that's a position that the courts would not be willing to accept. I think the most revealing moment in all of this in a court proceeding was in the hearing in Rasul, when Justice Ginsburg asked the Solicitor General's office, are you saying that even if we tortured people in Guantanamo, they would have no access to any courts and there'd be no relief they can get? And the response was, well, of course, the United States military would never engage in torture. By coincidence, that night were the first reports of Abu Ghraib. And I just don't think you can say that whatever their positions have been in the legal arguments, the reality has been accord with the law. The United States government, for the first time in history, is engaged in the systematic torture of people, including innocent people. And I don't think our courts are willing to step by and say, well, we'll just trust the military on that.
You know, I disagree with that. Abu Ghraib, frankly, was an example of a couple of soldiers who did bad things. Every one of them has been tried by JAG officers, defended by JAG officers. One is serving a 10-year prison sentence. Another is serving a 3-year prison sentence. There have been repeated investigations about what is going on, what happened at Abu Ghraib and what happened in Guantanamo Bay, and they have found 3 incidences in Guantanamo Bay of detainee abuse. And you know what those incidences were? A female interrogator made sexually suggestive remarks to a detainee. One of them sat briefly on the lap of a detainee. You know, inappropriate, yeah. Torture, absolutely not. So what, you know, yeah. So.
But wait a second. But Vice President Cheney.
So the point is, if I could finish my point. So the point is, you know, this notion that that U.S. soldiers are torturing and engage in systematic torture just absolutely is not right. Those soldiers who have done bad things, and what they found, what an independent investigation found, was that at Abu Ghraib you had some of the soldiers on the night shift who were doing their own thing and who were sadistic and were doing these horrible things to detainees. Those soldiers have been punished. You don't see that at Guantanamo Bay. There's these 3 incidences. There just is no evidence that there's this widespread torture happening by U.S. troops. Now, it is true, and I think the CIA has a problem, and I talk about this in my book. It is true that there have been 3 detainees who were waterboarded. 3. Now, I object to waterboarding. I think it is torture, and I think that Congress ought to ban it. But it's interesting that Congress has had all this time and refuses to ban waterboarding. But there have been 3 incidences. It's not widespread. It's not systematic. It's not U.S. soldiers. So I think that we need to put it into context and really look at what the facts are.
I wasn't going to jump into the torture issue, but I think it's true that you can't actually separate detention power and interrogation policy. So
let me actually not true. And I want to say I think the torture debate gets people riled up. And I think it will get people riled up, and I think it's inevitable that it will get people riled up. There's an old saying, the first person to invoke the Nazis in an argument loses, right? I mean, I think, you know, this is not to demean the torture argument, it's not to say it's not an important torture argument, but I think the torture argument is in some ways separable from what we're actually trying to talk about here, right? I mean,
in some ways, but I also think that it's artificial to separate, not necessarily the torture issue, but the interrogation policy generally plays a significant role in the question of who ought to be detained.
I don't disagree, and I also think it's odd to say that Congress hasn't acted to ban torture when it's a use Kogan's norms of international law, and B, the torture statute was passed in 1994.
Why don't they just ban waterboarding? Why don't they ban it? Why don't they ban it?
You don't pass another statute that says a special kind of murder is unlawful when murder is already defined as
being
unlawful.
Why, if it's unclear, and they think it's wrong, and they sure are aggressive about attacking the Bush administration because of it, just ban it.
I can almost hear, if Marty Lederman were here, he'd say waterboarding is important, but that's not the main issue. As you say, Kendra, it's rarely applied. So let's take Katani at Guantanamo and not waterboarding, at least I don't think waterboarding, but long periods kept awake, isolation, loud music, the whole sort of 9 yards of maybe not exactly physical, but certainly not just sitting on the lap and so forth. So do we have a consensus on whether his treatment was torture or not torture?
To be perfectly honest, I think for the question of what role the court should play, the answer to that question is irrelevant. I mean, you know, I think the answer is yes. I think reasonable people will think the answer is no. Right? But I think the larger point is that whether we have judicial review of these kinds of questions shouldn't turn on the answer, right? It should turn on whether we actually want courts to ask the question.
Which comes back to Mike's point about comparative institutional competence. Now, at this point, let's see if we have any questions from the audience, and if anybody does, yes, Fran. Oh, yeah, okay, so everybody come up to the mic and you have questions, and if...
there are questions?
There are questions. I thought we had resolved all the issues and created a room-wide consensus, but apparently not. And perhaps I'll ask everyone who comes to the mic to introduce themselves briefly.
Raise my voice at the end like I'm pretending to question. One of them is it is in Bominion, it is interesting that Kennedy says the people before him range from people captured in Bosnia, turned over by the Bosnian government, to people captured on the battlefield with an AK-47 in their hand. And it does strike me that that's relevant to the question of jurisdiction, because we've never had before review of people who are captured on the battlefield with an AK-47 and whether or not they wear a uniform. But getting to the torture, which is the main concern, I think torture is wrong, and I think that the waterboarding is torture. And it is important to realize the military has never done it that we know of. It's the CIA, and I think most of these problems are the CIA. Even the people in Abu Ghraib, they weren't not only the night shift, they weren't the interrogators. They were just sadistic people who liked to fool around. But Irwin said something that I really disagree with. He said, with respect to the torture, two things. One is it doesn't work. We don't get reliable information. That's the second thing. That suggests that that's a utilitarian objection to torture. If it only did work, if we got reliable information, we can see that it does work. You know, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had waterboarding. He broke in, I guess, about a minute and a half, which was a long time. And he gave something very useful. We know that from the unclassified information. I still think it's wrong. It's easy to see that you're able, if you torture somebody, you can get information that's reliable. The guy says, yes, I did it, and I hid the gun and the money under the oak tree. You go to the oak tree, there you find the gun, the money was fingerprinted. That's nice, reliable information. The ticking bomb scenario. You know, Irwin said, but we don't have a ticking bomb. I think it's morally wrong. It's forbidden by our statutes and so on. I think by the Eighth Amendment, and I'm troubled by anybody that would suggest, as Alan Dershowitz does, that if there is a ticking bomb, then you can torture. My problem is, if once you say that, and I think you never know there's, you just think there's a ticking bomb, you really think it a lot, and then you do something torturing this individual. He doesn't tell you. Is it because you haven't tortured him enough, or because he doesn't really know? And once you say it's permissible, the incentive is to torture him some more. Because you find the ticking bomb, you're a hero. And if you don't find it and get blown up, you're going to be in trouble. And so I'm troubled by the utilitarian argument, which I often see on the left, as well as the right, saying it doesn't work. If it really didn't work, the Israelis wouldn't do it. Other people wouldn't do it. It's been around for thousands of years because it does work, which is a reason why we shouldn't do it. That's my comment.
We actually agree. I don't disagree with you. I mean, I think there's... I think one question is, did the United States government engage in systematic torture? And I couldn't disagree more with Professor Kendra Rotunda. And again, I couldn't more highly recommend that you read Jane Mayer's The Dark Side, because I don't think you can read it and come away with conclusion other than that the United States government at the highest levels systematically implemented a policy of torture. Second, you raise the question of, is it effective? I'm glad to say that torture is immoral and we should condemn it and not use it, even if it is effective. On the other hand, as I think is documented in this book, in the Susskind book, in many other sources, it shows that in terms of getting information from individual, torture is much less effective than other ways of building rapport and interrogation. But I don't need to get there, because I'm glad to agree with you. We shouldn't do it even if it's effective.
Look, you can write volumes on allegations that detainees have made. Every detainee is now saying they've been tortured. The truth is their training manual tells them to do that. I had some firsthand experience with this, frankly, when I worked with investigators. We had outstanding rapport with one of the detainees who'd worked with. He was constantly giving us information. After the CSIRT hearing started and lawyers started coming to Guantanamo Bay, we started having detainees allege that they were tortured. And in one interview, we had the detainee all of a sudden out of nowhere just say, oh, I should tell you, I've been tortured. And the investigator said, what do you mean? What happened to you? Who did what? And he was like a deer in the headlight. He didn't know. I mean, it was really very clear. He really didn't know what torture even meant. He just said, oh, I don't know, I've been tortured. What, did somebody touch you? I don't know, I've just been tortured. So, you know, these people are trained to say that. And so it's not surprising that there are volumes or that there are books based on these allegations that detainees have made. The truth is they really have not been corroborated. You know, where are the indictments? If there are soldiers who have tortured, if this has happened widespread, let's bring them in, let's try them, we should know about it. And that's not what's happened. There have been investigations, and they found that there have been these abuses here and there. There were some at Abu Ghraib, about 70 instances of detainee abuse. Those people are in prison now, those soldiers who were involved.
I just want to say briefly, I mean, I if this turns into a battle of the anecdotes, nobody's going to convince anybody of anything, right? Evil people will lie. I think that is not a statement that anyone, notwithstanding how much we're all going to disagree about everything, I don't think anyone's going to disagree that evil people in some circumstances will lie. That some people lie about being tortured does not mean torture doesn't happen. That some people allege that they were tortured does not mean that torture does happen, right? I'm with Irwin that I think that the Canadian government is a fairly authoritative source. That I think that the Red Cross is a fairly authoritative source. That doesn't mean that everyone who claims they've been tortured has been tortured. It doesn't mean that even most of the people who claim they've been tortured have been tortured. Again, I think torture is a critically important issue that is entirely a red herring to the conversation we're trying to have.
And I know we could go on about this for a while, but let's get back to the Q&A.
As you know, the Beaumedien case relied heavily on historical analysis, and so I'm going to get away from the excitement of the moment and ask a historical question. I'm going to read four statements that are extracted from questions that the Beaumedien court had to deal with, and I'd like anyone who wants to respond to it to answer, give me your reaction to it. I'm sure you will, in particular, Michael. Number one, what the Constitution requires in absence of a valid suspension is not a procedure that's like habeas corpus, but habeas corpus. Number two, habeas corpus follows the king's ministers, and by extension, the president's functionaries, wherever they are, including in foreign lands. Number three, all subjects are entitled to habeas corpus, which includes not just citizens, but anyone who has voluntarily put himself under the protection of the law, such as James Somerset, for example. Number four, habeas corpus does not apply to foreigners who are not subjects, specifically foreigners who have been captured and have not sought protection of American jurisprudence.
Or American jurisdiction. Any responses?
I think I have this right, at least right in the sense that this is what I think. The first third, and fourth statements are correct, and the second one is not.
For those of us who lost track, spell that one out.
The second one was habeas corpus follows the king's ministers wherever they go, including foreigners.
So here's my question. My question has always been, let's put habeas aside for a second. Let's turn to something that I think is a little less blood dander raising. I was going to say blood curdling, but that seemed to be a poor choice of words. Let's take the ex post facto clause. Right, a fairly uncontroversial, friendly, you know, neutral constitutional provision. I cannot imagine that anyone of any political stripe would take seriously the argument that Congress could pass ex post facto laws so long as they only apply to non-citizens outside the territory of the United States. Right, I don't know where you would find a warrant in the Constitution for the notion that the limit on ex post facto laws or the Commerce Clause. What's that? Every court to reach the question held that the Nuremberg Tribunal itself and all of the control council courts that followed it were not exercising the United States jurisdiction. They were international creations, exercising a peculiarly international. I mean, that's exactly why in Hirota the Supreme Court says it could not review the convictions of Japanese war criminals in the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal. So my point is just to say, I think, and I continue to think, that most of the people we're talking about are bound to lose on the merits, that they don't have that the scope of their substantive rights that they can enforce in a U.S. federal court are very limited. But I think it's odd to suggest that there are structural constitutional provisions that simply don't apply outside the territorial United States. I think that's a rights question, not a structural question. I think the founders would be surprised to hear that the federal government, the centralized power of which they were so nervous of, has unlimited power just so long as it acts outside, you know, the 13 colonies.
Julian,
well, I was not making any statement about other constitutional provisions. The habeas right is tied to the historical existence of habeas at the time, and I think the evidence that that there was worldwide habeas at the time is very thin, and I think that there's a very strong textual support for that, which is that the suspension clause appears to allow suspension of habeas only within the United States. That is, it applies in case of invasion or rebellion. It does not appear to allow suspension of habeas in the case of a foreign war. And I think that what that indicates is that they didn't understand habeas to run to foreign wars.
But Mike, isn't it just possible that the reason why the suspension clause invokes rebellion and invasion is because those are the two circumstances where domestic circumstances would be such that the courts were unable to function, right? I mean, a foreign war, no matter how total in its scope, right, doesn't undermine the functioning of a civilian government within the territorial of the United States, right? I mean, isn't that at least a plausible reading of why they would focus on rebellion or invasion and add that rebellion or invasion isn't even enough, right? It has to be a case of rebellion or invasion where the public safety requires closing the courts.
The question is whether that's a plausible account, but is that more plausible than an account that explains it in terms of not the founders not conceiving that federal judges would have any part to partake in overseas foreign conflicts?
If we're talking about what the founders didn't conceive, I'm sorry.
Well, particularly in light of the fact that there was no worldwide habeas under English practice.
Well, wait a second. I mean, the question is, what do you mean by worldwide habeas, right? I mean, the British Empire, you know, the sun never set on the British Empire in the 18th century, right? I mean, so as if it was within the jurisdiction of the British Empire, there was habeas. If it was outside the jurisdiction of the British Empire, there wasn't. But, you know, that wasn't that many places where the British government was detaining people in the 18th century.
Michael, I don't think that's correct. I think habeas could be claimed by British subjects who, for example, were under the jurisdiction of a military officer or royal governor.
British subjects. British subjects.
British subjects, that's correct.
Right. I think that there's some question about whether that's true or not, but I think the American understanding in the early 19th century anyway was that that's correct. That's why I agreed with your third proposition. But habeas did not run to non-British subjects overseas. That's what I mean by worldwide habeas. I mean, you get it regardless of who you are and where you are.
But if someone came and voluntarily subjected himself to British laws and British protection, he was entitled to habeas.
Yes.
And
even combatants.
Wait a second. Just really quickly, because I want to get to Julian's question. Just really quickly. Yeah. When we say that the answer is no, that's not because there are five or six decisions by the King's Bench in the 18th century saying, because this person is a non-citizen combatant, we have no power. There are the point that Kennedy made in his opinion for many, which I think is telling, is the cases admit of both readings, and the precedent is simply unclear. And so the answer may very well be no, but I don't think we can – but there's no smoking gun. There's no, you know, Lopez saying the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Julian.
I hate to break up that discussion. I wanted to sort of applaud – I mean, this is one of the best panels I've seen that's dealt with this very difficult issue. So I want to just congratulate you guys. I did have a question. I want to turn us a little forward because I think there is some practical going forward question for – The backwards-looking question, which is, was it reasonable for the Bush administration to adopt some of the positions it did take, for instance, with respect to their right to detain people, the presidential powers or separation powers or otherwise, whether or not they are constrained by the Torture Convention and to what degree, et cetera. In the talk about prosecutions of Bush administration officials going forward, so I'd be curious about the, and you know, I take this as a very real and serious possibility within the U.S. system or even outside the U.S. system, and I was curious whether I think I have some sense of the views of a couple of the panelists, but I was curious of whether Dean Chemerinsky and Professor Vladek had views on whether or not they believe that, especially Dean Chemerinsky, a systematic system that prosecutions of the Bush administration officials is the proper way to go, investigations or truth commissions or whatever, what he thinks, in his view, the proper process should be in the Obama administration.
Yes, I believe that the individuals who designed the policies of the Bush administration and implemented them, especially with regard to torture, should be investigated and prosecuted for war crimes. Unlike what Professor Rotunda says, this isn't just allegations of people on the battlefield who made it up. For example, if you look at page 203 of Jane Mayer's book, she quotes contemporaneous emails from FBI agents that document the torture that went on. In light of that, in light of how it violated international law and American law, I think these were international human rights violations. And so I think that though there's going to be an enormous temptation to just say, that's the past, let's look no further, I think there needs to be a full investigation and prosecution of people like Dick Cheney, David Addington, John Yoo, Alberto Gonzalez, who implemented the torture of people.
Julian, I'm gonna split the hair a little bit. I don't disagree with Irwin in my view of history. I think there could be prosecutions. I think it is not the best idea. I think I'd be far more interested in not a truth commission, but in some kind of structure where we gathered all the information, right? Where instead of having us fighting over anecdotes for the next quarter century, there was actually some body with subpoena and contempt power that could take evidence and find out, you know, and sort of settle the historical record so that instead of having, you know, the four of us fighting over facts, we can actually get to the bottom of what happened. Now, it may be that some of the things we learn in that process provides even stronger and more direct evidence that there are certain people who actually knowingly broke the law. But I think, you know, I would much rather see that process happen first and as a necessary antecedent to prosecutions.
Okay, just one clarification. Yeah, I'm sorry. The reason why I raised this was because you might imagine having to deal with legal arguments such as the much maligned commander-in-chief argument, that the statutes need to be interpreted consistent with the commander-in-chief's exclusive power to direct the military. And therefore, an investigation is going to have to run up against that legal question. But it does depend on whether you think that was I think the standard would be whether it was a reasonable legal argument at the time or even now to make the argument that the statute could be interpreted in a way, for instance, the torture statute, some other statute, that would permit, you know, that would be, we try to avoid the encroaching commander-in-chief powers. If we all agree, which I'm not sure we do, that that's a completely loser argument, and if you make that argument, you're subject to criminal punishment for being wrong, then that strikes me as a very difficult argument to make going forward.
But, Julian, that's why I think the fact-finding process will matter, right? And that's why I think you have to do the fact-finding process first. Let me sort of give you an example. For a long time, Justice Scalia and a number of government lawyers had argued that it was completely unthinkable that the federal courts would ever dare to hold that Guantanamo was subject to the territorial jurisdiction of the federal courts. We actually now know that there was a very live debate within the administration in the fall of 2001 with Paul Clement, who I think was then the Deputy Solicitor General, and Brad Berenson, who I think was then the Associate White House Counsel, saying quite pointedly, we actually are not sure. We think it's entirely possible that the courts will say Guantanamo is within the jurisdiction, right? So the facts, I think, will illuminate who knew what people thought were reasonable arguments, and those possible cases where people acted flagrantly in defiance of what they knew to be clearly established law.
Let me intervene here real quick. We're running short on time, but as we talk about this, I wonder about what impact these types of inquiries have on both the willingness of attorneys to come forward to serve in national security law positions in the administration in the future and the way they're going to feel about giving their advice. And we talk about, you know, you talk about Brad and Paul, you know, making these arguments. And I wonder what the argument would look like if they all thought that 8 years down the road a truth commission was going to be looking over their shoulders. Now, it may be a good thing. Maybe this would have kept us further from the torture line. Or maybe it's a bad thing. Maybe this is going to chill the giving of good advice in the future. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I got in trouble with some of my mentors because I said publicly that I didn't think the lawsuit against John Yoo was a good idea, right, the civil lawsuit. Not because I didn't think that it was a plausible legal theory, right, but because I think it looks odd. Right. I mean, I think, you know, I think we have various doctrines that protect government officials who act reasonably and who act in good faith based upon what they think are reasonable interpretations of the law. Right. Those of you, I mean, many of us are probably well familiar with the qualified immunity doctrine in damages cases.
Well, this is why the Rasul civil litigation is such an important case.
And I think the reality of the situation is that in most cases there will be qualified immunity. But that goes back to my point to Julian, which is the fact-finding matters, because it may yet come out that there were some cases where it was clear from the lawyers that something was illegal and someone said, well, we have to do it anyway. And I think those cases present a totally different situation from fighting over what common Article 3 does and does not apply to.
Let's do this. Let's get the two final questions relatively briefly stated, and then we'll have the panelists respond and wrap things up because we only have just a minute or two left.
Yeah, hi. My name is Peter Honigsberg, and actually I just wrote a book that Professor Chemerinsky was kind enough to write the foreword to, so you know my bias. But I'm addressing three different issues, that one of which just came up this moment. I'm very concerned about truth commissions, and actually have raised over $100,000 to create an NGO-type truth commission that I'm going forward with outside of an official government-sponsored truth commission. I'm hoping to create one with NGO sponsors. There are some people who actually support that, and I'm one of them. I strongly believe that we don't interview as many of the survivors out of Guantanamo as possible. People might deny Guantanamo even existed, as they tried to do with the Holocaust 40 years later. Shoah Foundation is part of my model on this, and I'm hoping to have statement takers around the world interviewing every detainee who's still alive that we can find and get their story, and also take commission hearings of all habeas attorneys and all translators and any other soldiers and guards who care to testify. Okay, that's one thing. But I did want to talk to torture, because in this book of mine, and it's really important that people understand what I was listening to, and I apologize, I came in late, but I think it wasn't changed. What I was listening to is all about physical torture. But, you know, first of all, when we've had torture panels at my law school, no one's ever defined torture. I'm not sure, John, you tried, but I don't think many people are purchasing that definition. But whatever it is, torture involves mental torture, perhaps much more than physical torture. And I think we need to understand sensory deprivation is a lot worse to most people than being physically hung on a rail. I think Jose Padilla, which no one mentioned, at least if they did, I wasn't here when it was.
He
was clearly tortured, sensory deprived in ways that... you know, many of actually the frequent flyer program in Guantanamo was not unlike that either. If you ever stayed up for 20 nights in a row with your children and never slept, you can appreciate what the frequent flyer program was about. And the third thing is on categories. You know, obviously, prior to 9/11, there were two categories of combatants, lawful and unlawful, in the Geneva Convention. Enemy combatant didn't exist. Kieran didn't really establish it, as we know. And the fact that it's now become a term of art does not give it credibility until 2006 under the MCA, when it was statutorily defined. Prior to that, we just had those two, and all detainees were captured, were under one of those two categories of lawful and unlawful.
Thanks, Peter. Before we get responses, brief responses, a quick brief question following up from Peter Margulies.
This is a follow-up for Mike, but I'm happy to get responses from other folks, too, on the cases that Steve mentioned early in the Republic that indicate that the judiciary was less than deferential to the executive. Another good example of that is Little versus Barem, where the court said we picked up a vessel leaving France because we're concerned about commercial interrelationships with France at that time. And Justice Marshall had no trouble in saying that if you wanted to pick up the vessel when it was heading toward France, that would be okay, because that's what Congress said you could do. But Congress didn't say you could pick up when it was leaving from France. And Marshall was happy to say, we're not going to defer to the executive. If necessary, we'll ask the ship's captain to pay damages as a result.
Thanks, Peter. Just very brief closing remarks from everybody, and we've hit our time limit, starting with Dean Chemerinsky.
Sure. Thank you again for letting me be part of this. To me, what this is about is human beings who are being imprisoned indefinitely, maybe for life, human beings tortured physically and emotionally. And the phrase that hasn't been uttered this morning is the rule of law. Because ultimately the question here is, does law apply to this, and can courts enforce it? Professor Ramsey said earlier today, we have checks. We can rely on the voters and we rely on Congress. I think when you're dealing with fundamental human rights, imprisoning of individuals for life, torturing individuals, we don't rely on the political process. That's exactly what we need the courts to do, to uphold the rule of law. And that's really what this is about. Does the rule of law apply in the context of the war on torture?
Mike?
Let me respond quickly to Peter's question, because I think it actually lets me make my my general point about a lot of these controversies. I absolutely agree with the result in Little versus Barem. I think that, and I'm not trying to argue that the president is above the law. And I'm certainly not trying to argue the president is above statutory law, as the president didn't claim that in Little, but I think he wasn't going to get it anyway. I think that it's right that the president has to follow the statutory law. What I'm concerned about is not so much the relationship between the president and Congress, but the relationship between the president and the judiciary, and the judiciary moving in unsupported by statute. And again, I agree with some of the things, quite a number of things that Steve has said about the court's ability to interpret statutes. But when we're talking about the Median, we are not talking about an interpretation of a statute. When we're talking about Hamdan, I'm not sure we're really talking about an interpretation of a statute, although that's the allegation. What we're really talking about is the courts taking over from the president the factual determinations about how to conduct military operations, and I find that to be of great concern. And I think this is I'll agree. But of course, disagree with Dean Chemerinsky's closing remark. I do think that's the critical question. I don't find it helpful to talk about whether it's a rule of law or not. I think it's a question of which institution is going to be in charge of making policy determinations in foreign affairs, and I think that the Constitution sets that to the executive.
Professor Rotunda.
Well, of course, the rule of law applies. And what we're finding is that detainees in Guantanamo Bay are receiving more procedural protections than enemy combatants any ever were held in the history of the world. And the same is true at their military commissions. We have very elaborate procedures. It's important to remember that at Nuremberg, there were these 12 little very basic procedures that applied. In Guantanamo Bay, we have the Military Commissions Act, which affords all kinds of rights and privileges, extensive discovery. In fact, it includes a definition of conspiracy that departs from the U.S. definition of conspiracy. It makes it more difficult to convict someone of conspiracy held in Guantanamo Bay than it would be to convict you or I of conspiracy in the United States. So we are seeing extensive procedures for detainees, and, of course, the rule of law applies.
Thanks. And Professor Vladek.
I just want to say, first of all, I love conversations like this because I think so many of these conferences have four people who all either agree with each other or are talking about completely different things. And it's refreshing for once to have people actually trying to shout over each other because they actually, you know, are talking about the same thing. Everyone's been plugging their books or someone else's books. I don't have any books.
But you can download his articles.
I was going to say, apparently I can remedy that.
By the way, I do have a book.
I've actually read
the
your
Constitution's
book.
Constitution's text.
I read your book, and I assigned Irwin's book to my students. I would encourage all of you to actually, if you're really sort of interested in the structural side of this, right, and more than just the politics of it, I would encourage you to go back and read Justice Kennedy's opinion in Boumediene again, but read it with a slightly different lens. Forget which side you're on. Forget the merits for a second. Look for why Justice Kennedy says we have habeas corpus, right? I mean, what really struck me, I'm not usually a Kennedy fan, even when he's on the side that I agree with, because I think he finds principles of expediency. But Boumediene is an atypical Kennedy opinion in that he actually spends a lot of time reflecting upon why we have habeas corpus. And he actually says habeas corpus is not primarily, or it's not solely or even primarily, about an individual's right to have a day in court. He actually repeatedly talks about the relationship between habeas corpus and the separation of powers. And this goes back to Mike's point, right, that for Kennedy, habeas corpus is about protecting the courts. And, you know, we may think the courts have overreached. You know, it's entirely possible. But one of the things that's unique to the war on terrorism context is Congress had never so directly before tried to cut the courts out of the loop in a context like this. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, however much we trust the president, however much we trust the military, however much we trust the CIA, if the courts are physically and literally disenfranchised from passing upon the merits of what they do, I think that trust is really fairly empty, right? And I think that trust has little in the way of checks. And so I think, you know, in looking at where things go from here, whatever one views of the merits of Boumediene, I think the theory of why habeas corpus is important is a very interesting place to start.
Terrific. Let's give our panelists a big round of applause.